A new children's novel begins in the voice of a boy who says, "I know I'm not an ordinary 10-year-old kid." It emerges that the boy was born with a deformed face. Although he says, "I won't describe what I look like," whatever you're thinking, it's probably worse. August Pullman, Augie to his family, is the central character in the novel Wonder. We meet him after years of operations and homeschooling when he's finally going away to school for the first time. The author writes under the pen name R.J. Palacio. Friends know her as Raquel Jaramillo, and she says the novel grew out of a searing moment with her own children.
It actually came out of a chance encounter I'd had with a little girl who looks very much like Augie looks in the book. I was with my two children, and this was years ago now, and I was sitting in front of an ice cream store, and my younger son, who was about 3 at the time, was in the stroller facing me, and it was just one of those terrible moments when my kids didn't react the way I would have wanted them to react. And in order to spare this little girl's feelings, I ended up, you know, just kind of running away from the scene. And I kept on thinking about this incident, and it kept on replaying in my mind. I honestly felt so badly about it. And I started writing the book that very night.
So you create a school full of kids and teachers who have to deal with this very circumstance when a boy nicknamed Augie comes into the school, and when you eventually have his face described by one of the characters in the book, I guess one way to put it would just be like a normal face seen in a funhouse mirror. Nothing is where it should be. That's the kind of face we're talking about here.
Pretty much, yeah. He's born with a facial deformity. There are many syndromes that cause different types of facial disfigurements, and in the book, he has a combination of a couple of different syndromes, which makes him something of a medical wonder.
And one of the powerful things about this book is that you begin from the perspective of Augie himself.
Well, I thought it was important to have a spin. This is primarily written for children, and I wanted them to be able to walk in Augie's shoes and meet him and see him and feel through his eyes and his heart what it's like. And then what he looks like, in a sense, is very incidental to him. He really doesn't dwell on that very much. What he dwells on is the reaction that people have to him, because all he wants is to be an ordinary kid, but he really can't, because he'll always have people staring at him and reacting to him in a certain way. Then by the time we get to the point in the book where he is described, I think the reader just feels so protective of him that you don't really care anymore what he looks like, and you just want to help him. You just want to be friends with him.
You know, if the other kids were just out and out awful to Augie, it would almost be easier for the character to deal with. But kids are kind of subtle about it in ways that make it more excruciating. You even have one of the characters start mentioning a Star Wars character who has a burned face. I mean, there are all these little things that are done in class to make sure that he is reminded that people are looking at him.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, middle school is a tough time. And I don't know what it is about the middle school experience that turns kids into the Lord of the Flies, kind of, but it just does seem to be that way. And more than that, what's really touching to me about ultimately what happens in the book is the extraordinary acts of kindness that end up happening from those very kids who start out maybe feeling one way, maybe because the expectation is that kids will be mean to one another. Whenever one kid shows any kind of kindness or is noble, it almost takes on an extraordinary act of courage. It feels, you know, you're really rooting for the kids who stand up for Augie in a way. And ultimately, it's a feel-good book because it is a meditation on kindness and the impact of kindness.
Now, you just use that word kind. You put a teacher in the book who keeps putting what he calls precepts, fundamental rules, up on the blackboard. And the first one was the most striking. And I'm paraphrasing here, but I believe he writes on the board, "Given a choice between being right and being kind, choose to be kind."
Yeah, I love that.
But it's a surprising choice to make because you would think they're the same thing.
Exactly. I think it's that choice that's so important. And I think that that becomes the subtext of the entire book. It's really not so much about bullying at all. In fact, it's really about how these kids just are, how Augie comes into their lives and they all become better for it and they all rise to the occasion.
Now, one of your kids was going through middle school when you were writing this, correct?
Yes.
It would be tempting to ask if his experience informed what you were doing, but I almost want to ask that the other way around. Did the act of writing this story start to cause you to think about your own son's experiences in different ways?
I think so, and I think it also caused me to go back into my childhood as well and wonder who I was. I think not so much my son's experiences, but also relating to parents of my son's friends with whom, you know, we've all known each other for years, and seeing how in the fifth grade when old friends take divergent paths and friendships get broken and kids that you knew since kindergarten and had many multiple sleepovers with, suddenly, you know, there's that split that happens as personalities are formed and changed and kids take on different personas. And I did a lot of thinking about parental roles and what we do. Do we interfere too much? Do we not interfere? What the expectations are? I have a lot of friends who very much had the attitude, even if they knew that their kids weren't being very nice, it was more, well, let the kids work it out for themselves. What I always thought about that is that there's usually some kid that's on the losing side of that equation. So it wasn't so much about my son's experiences or even mine. It was more about the social experience in general.
That does underline how vividly we remember these times that get to be rather distant as we grow older.
They do, and then they can come back at the drop of a hat. You know, you see a little girl in your son's school that reminds you of who you used to be, and you're like, oh my goodness, or vice versa. You kind of realize that there are kids that you wish you'd gotten to know better, who were terrifically nice, and maybe you didn't give them too much time. It's tough to go back sometimes and think about who you were. I mean, I certainly was not a mean girl at all. And I pretty much, I think, was a very, very nice girl, but I think I could have been nicer at times, too.
Well, Raquel Jaramillo, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Her pen name is R.J. Palacio, and her new novel is Wonder. And young readers can discover more titles by joining NPR's Backseat Book Club. Each month, our program All Things Considered picks a book and takes listeners' questions for the author. This month's selection is at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
These days, a darling of the tech and business world is Pinterest. It's a virtual scrapbooking site that allows users to organize photos, recipes, images they like, and pin them to an online bulletin board. Nearly 18 million users logged into the site last month alone. So when Kirsten Kowalski wrote a blog post wondering whether Pinterest users risked violating copyright laws, it went viral. Kowalski is a lawyer and photographer and Pinterest user herself.
I went to the terms, and the first thing I saw is that you're not allowed to post anything that you don't own or that you don't have all rights or license to use. And that's where the conflict was coming in and the confusion among users.
Kowalski made those comments on the podcast Bloomberg Law. We wanted to know, what's the difference between this site and any other where you might share images online? So joining us from Irvine, California is Jonathan Pink, an attorney who heads the internet and new media team at the law firm Bryan Cave. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hello.
So to start, what is the difference between this site and any other? And what does the law say about the right of people to copy images and repost them like this?
Well, in many ways, Pinterest is no different than any other user-generated site. Perhaps it's more image-oriented than most, but for the most part, it's not terribly different. And what the law says, the Copyright Act says with respect to the using of images that belong to other people, is pretty basic, and that is that one may not reproduce or prepare a derivative work based on or distribute copies of photographs that one doesn't own, absent those works falling into certain exceptions, fair use being one of them, public domain being another, or unless the, in this case, Pinterest pinner has obtained permission from the copyright owner of those images.
Now, the CEO for Pinterest has reached out to this blogger, Kirsten Kowalski, and to try and figure out ways that could satisfy users like her. They've also sent out statements saying that Pinterest does warn people that they need to get permission from the copyright owner before pinning or reposting an image. So what has been the danger here for users? I mean, it is essentially the issue that it's all on us as the user to ensure that these things happen and that Pinterest has sort of absolved itself of any risk.
Well, right. I mean, that is the problem, because Now, as you say, the Pinterest terms and conditions effectively say, look, we're wiping our hands of this. This is all on you. You're representing and warranting to us that you own these images or that you have permission to use them. And in fact, copyright is what we call a strict liability crime. And what that means is that simply because I didn't realize or you didn't realize that they may be liable for copyright infringement, that doesn't absolve them of a claim for copyright infringement. They're stuck.
So, Jonathan, when you think of sites like Facebook and Tumblr and like Pinterest and all these digital sites where there's image sharing going on, does it seem like the current regulations have kept up with the technology?
Well, right. And I don't think the current regulations have kept up with the technology. And we don't want to stifle either the creativity of the artist or the ancillary creativity of we, those who are viewing the arts. And so because of that, I think that it is time for the Copyright Act to come current and figure out how it can coexist with technology in the modern world.
Jonathan, thanks so much for explaining it to us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's attorney Jonathan Pink. He heads the internet and new media team at the law firm Brian Cave. He spoke to us about how copyright law applies to social networking sites like Pinterest.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. As women around the world are rethinking and rewriting their roles in society, we decided to take a look at how the biographies of notable women reflect those changes. So throughout Women's History Month, we've been digging into biographies of all kinds of women, divas, dancers, leaders of nations, and queens of fashion. And today, we're talking about a woman who, although she died four decades ago, is back in the news. We're talking about nurse and activist Margaret Sanger, the founder of the organization that eventually became Planned Parenthood. Sanger began her efforts in behalf of sex education and contraception at a time when even talking about contraception was considered obscene and in some places even criminal. Women risked arrest when they sought out makeshift birth control devices that were often unsafe. To this day, Margaret Sanger is lauded by many for her work in changing that and, as well, vilified by others for ushering in a culture that her critics say devalues life and women in the process. Her life and work are chronicled in the new book, Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. The author is Jean Baker. She is an historian and history professor at Goucher College, and she's with us now in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Michelle.
Tell us how you got interested in her. I understand that your interest in her arose from your work reporting on the suffragist movement.
Mm-hmm. I wrote a book in published in 2004 on the suffrage movement. And after the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920, it just seemed the women's movement disappeared, with one exception. And, of course, that was Margaret Sanger, whose campaign for birth control grew more and more popular during the 20s and the 1930s, so I thought that this would be an appropriate topic. I was somewhat interested in it because of the fact that Sanger is demonized. And to me, this makes no sense. This is a woman who liberated women, who established various kinds of approaches to their sexuality that would prevent them from always worrying that every time they had sex, they would become pregnant.
Where did she develop this passion? The book is called Her Life of Passion, this passion for this issue.
Well, in her autobiography, she tells us there's this epical event that happens in 1912 when, as a nurse, she goes down to take care of a woman who's hemorrhaging as a result of a botched abortion. And Sanger, during this visit, when the hemorrhaging was stopped, the Sadie Sachs, this 25-year-old woman with four or five children, said, "What can I do to have no more children?" And the doctor said, "Tell Jake to sleep on the roof." 6 months later, Sanger went back, and Sadie Sachs was dying of septicemia, an infection, and she died. And this is the moment, as Sanger tells the story, that she decided to devote her life to making birth control accessible, cheap, and effective for American women.
One of the things you point out in the book is that she was repeatedly arrested for this work, something that I think many people forget. I just want to play a short clip from a 1957 interview that she did with journalist Mike Wallace of 60 Minutes fame. But before he was there, he was with an ABC News program where she explained what some of her motivation was. Here it is.
I naturally didn't want to see women take all the suffering of childbearing and of pregnancies. No one had tried to change the laws. And at that time, not even a doctor had a right to use the United States mails and common carriers for books, for learning, for anything that he had to do with this question. It was considered obscene.
Now, I'm just playing a clip of her voice so you can hear her speak. But what we don't have time to play for you is how Mike Wallace grilled her over the course of this interview, in part about her personal life, because she had been married and a wife and a mother earlier in her life, but she did leave her family in part to pursue her activism and also was a believer in what people later would call the free love movement. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Well, let me say a word about the Wallace interview. Many of her friends thought that it was pretty much of a disaster. At the end, Wallace turns to her and says, perhaps the women of America are becoming too independent and not staying home with their families enough. Of course, this was the kind of thing that infuriated Margaret Sanger, who, as a mother, had often left her children. She had three children, one died, and the two boys, to lead a very different kind of life.
But she has, to this day, continued to be attacked by conservatives, in part, well, and also progressives, which we'll talk about, in part on the grounds that Mike Wallace discussed in his interview, which is delinking sex from reproduction. And the argument then and now is that what this does is that it devalues women in society, that men have no reason to be responsible in their pursuit of sex because it can be sort of controlled and some would argue commodified. And I wonder, did she even talk about that in her own lifetime? Did she ever have that concern? How did she respond to that argument?
No, I don't think she ever had any concern. The issue of the conservatives about sex is one that she never confronted because she was in a struggle simply to get birth control legalized and effective. So in the context of believing that sex is making women into a commodity, that can only be the case if women are believed to be passionless Victorian women. If women are autonomous, then they will confront this matter of sexuality individually. And Sanger was a great believer that no woman was free who did not control her body.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking about Margaret Sanger, a leading figure in the women's health and reproductive rights movement. She is the founder of the organization that later became Planned Parenthood. I'm speaking with Jean Baker, author of Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. One issue on which some progressives and conservatives agree, and which has also, interestingly enough, resurfaced in recent years with certain campaigns aimed at particular communities and in urging them to change their attitudes about abortion, is her alignment with the eugenics movement, which discouraged reproduction by people with mental or physical disabilities, was later used as a rationale to sterilize people, including African Americans. And very interestingly enough, this story has resurfaced in recent months with people coming forward who were sterilized under these state-sponsored programs. You write in the book that she saw this very differently. Can you explain how she saw this? And you also point out she never, throughout her life, abandoned her belief in eugenics. So how did she see it?
I think that you have to resituate eugenics. Eugenics was not only involuntary sterilization, which is what we think about it post-Holocaust, but it was a progressive movement in the United States during the 20s and 30s in which everyone from Supreme Court justices to American presidents believed that by using science, that particularly biology, that you could make better human beings. Now, Sayers' take on this was always that the answer was birth control. Sayers, like a racehorse that you put blinders on, and the thing that she sees is birth control. Her view of eugenics initially was sort of a feminist eugenics, that if women use birth control, they will have better babies. They can space their babies. They will be able to afford their children. And all of this will make for better humans. Now, she did support sterilization for those who were insane, and she never rejected that or denied that.
Would you address the specific charge that she was a racist and that she thought that, in part, that birth control, contraception should be used to limit the numbers of people of different ethnic groups, not just African Americans, but also people of, Slavs, Poles, anybody who was not, Northern European. And I'm interested in your take on this, particularly because you write that you uncovered her nursing application. One of the reasons she was so interested in nursing is that this was a profession where you could serve humanity without regard for color, creed, religion, and so forth. So can you square that up? I mean, was she a racist or not?
I do not believe she was a racist. I think she was far ahead of most Americans of her time. I think that over and over again she said, I do not believe in any way that birth control or eugenics should affect races or groups. She opened a clinic in Harlem in 1931, and in her later actions, it's quite clear that she opposes racial segregation at a time when most Americans either paid no attention or favored racial segregation. So the racist charge is one that I do not think has any credibility. The eugenics charge is a little bit more complicated.
Why do you think it is that even at this late date, I mean, she died in 1966 after a very long life, she's still such a polarizing figure?
Well, I think it's the subject. And I also think that as we have emerged into a partisan environment, she has become someone who's useful for a group that wants to end abortion. Sayer never supported abortion at all. Her idea was that birth control will prevent abortion, which is, I think, a very simple point that some Americans today seem to have forgotten when they tried to close up Planned Parenthood.
Before we let you go, as I mentioned, we've been speaking this month about biographies of women, and we've talked about how women are so often characterized either as heroines or as villains. I'm wondering why you think that is, and how would you like Margaret Sanger to be viewed?
Well, of course I'd like her to be a hero with a messy life, because I think the problem of this dichotomy is that we put women into these categories and we lose the fact that they are human beings. I certainly would put, if I have to choose between hero or villain, I would choose hero, and I would suggest that she is someone who has changed all of our lives and who has made women's lives far, far better. We have only to remember Sanger's own childhood, the sixth of 11 poor children, the boys having to wear dresses to school, very little money, to remember that being able to plan your pregnancies is something that is extremely important for women, and it liberates them from the kind of maternity that simply submerged Margaret Sanger's mother.
Jean H. Baker is the author of Margaret Sanger, A Life of Passion. It's only her latest book. She's a history professor at Goucher College, and she was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Jean Baker, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Let's talk women's March Madness now. The NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament has reached its Sweet 16 this week, and USA Today columnist Christine Brennan has been following all the action and joined us in the studio to talk about it. Good to see you, Christine.
Great to see you, David.
So the biggest name in women's college basketball right now is Brittany Griner. She is an incredible athlete. She plays for Baylor University. They're doing well. I mean, tell us about her. Tell us about how Baylor's doing.
You know, we've heard a lot about game change in the last few weeks. Well, this is the game changer in women's sports, even, not just women's basketball. 6'8", junior center. She, in most games, she's 4 inches taller than the tallest opponent she's facing. And she's blocking shots. And the other day she dunked. She was only the second player ever to dunk in the women's tournament.
The second player ever in women's college basketball tournament.
Candace Parker did it back in 2006. And now Brittany Griner, just the other day in the second round, moving ahead now to the Sweet 16. She is a superstar in sports. It's a wonderful byproduct, I think, of Title IX.
Also, so Baylor is still going, and their region also includes really a sentimental favorite, Tennessee. I mean, such a rich women's basketball tradition, but it hasn't been an entirely happy story for them this year.
No, not all stories are happy ones in this tournament. And it's Pat Summitt, you're right, David.
Their coach.
Winner of 8 national titles with Tennessee, 59 years old, but she is battling early onset dementia. And it is tough to watch when you see her sitting on the bench watching a game, and you have one of her longtime assistant coaches, Holly Warlick, a former star at Tennessee, actually coaching the team. And Pat is sitting there coaching one-on-one a little bit, but otherwise watching. This is the fiery Pat Summitt that everyone knows, the winningest coach in NCAA basketball history, men's or women's. And you can start to see this disease have its effects on this incredible icon in the sport.
Is this her last season?
That's the question. And I know there's a lot of people who'd like to see Tennessee make the Final Four for that reason. But we don't know the answer to that, but it certainly could be.
Let's go to another bracket. A number 2 seed you've been keeping your eye on is Maryland.
That's correct. Maryland is coached by Brenda Fries, who won the national title in 2006 with a young Maryland team back then, upstart team, a second seed then. And this team looks exactly the same, very young, led by a sophomore and other young players. And Brenda Fries also has a backstory. One of her 4-year-old twin sons has leukemia. Hmm. And for the last year and a half, they've been battling that. So, again, the storylines here, it's the court, but it's also the family. Stories behind the players or the coaches, in this case with Brenda Fries.
Well, and given that drama and some of these stories that you're talking about on and off the court, I mean, one thing I've always wondered is whether there's a way to get more focus on the women's tournament when so much attention is paid to the men and the women seem to play in the shadow.
It's a great question. And yeah, the men, it's not just sports. It's a cultural event in our country, March Madness, on the men's side. And yet you hear the word bracket all the time. Well, it should be plural. There are two going on at the same time, the men's and the women's. And there's conversation about whether they should move the women's tournament up several weeks so it comes in advance of the men's tournament, which I think would give it a lot more attention, or even playing the women's Final Four at the same time in the same city as the men's Final Four. I do think they have to do something because all these great stories, and they're basically ignored in the mainstream sports media.
All right. Well, they will certainly not be ignored by you. You'll be following all the action as it plays out. Enjoy the rest of the tournament. Thanks so much for being here, Christine.
Thank you very much, David.
It's USA Today sports columnist Christine Brennan.
Now we are going to turn to matters of personal finance. You might be celebrating the start of spring by rushing outside and catching some sunshine now, or throwing open the windows to take care of that spring cleaning. But our next guest says the deep clean you might really want to do this spring isn't your blinds or your attic, it's your finances. Here to tell us more about this is Gail Blanke. You might remember her from when she joined us to talk about her book, Throw Out 50 Things, earlier this year. She's also an executive life coach. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so glad to be with you.
Now, we talked to you about throwing out 50 things a little while ago, but you also told us that you want to check some things off your financial list this spring as well. Why is that so important?
You know, I think in general, what builds up over the year, I call it life plaque, that clogs the arteries of our lives and weighs us down, holds us back, curbs our enthusiasm, all that stuff. And interestingly enough, one of the major culprits in terms of sapping our enthusiasm is the financial mess that we allow to build up.
Well, how would you get started if you decided, yeah, that's me?
Well, to tell you the truth, I would start by cleaning out a drawer in the kitchen before you get into your financial stuff, because I think people feel so worked up about their financial mess and so overwhelmed that they just feel they can't get into it. So you know, you want to kind of go easy on yourself and start with that good old drawer in the kitchen. And once you get that cleared out, you build up your energy. Then you can go into the drawer or the box that has all that financial stuff in there that you haven't looked at. You know, the financial statements, the old bills, the pay stubs. I mean, there is stuff that should be shredded. That, you know, there are certain things you do have to keep for a certain period of time. But the idea of starting small and not making a big deal is really important, particularly in this very emotional subject of our finances.
You say that it's time to throw out your relationship with money. What do you mean by that?
I think many of us, and I think that it's particularly women, have a very negative relationship with money, if we have any relationship at all. We just we don't treat that relationship with respect like we would, you know, another relationship. In the end, it's like we don't really want to know about it. That's why we keep putting it aside. I mean, look at our other relationships that are important. Would we treat our children like that? You know, no. We make sure they have the right things, that they're cared for, that, you know, everything's working okay with them. And we don't do that with this particular relationship. One of the things I asked a woman the other day, would you just not get a mammogram because you didn't want to know what it said? Well, that's how we treat our financial life. I'm not opening up that bank statement because I don't want to know what it says. So we have to treat it with respect.
It's interesting that you say that because, you know, it's often said that men are prone to that kind of not wanting to know when it comes to their health, whereas women are prone to not wanting to know when it comes to their money. It's just one of those curious kind of contrasts. So how would you start? So you say clear out the papers and the bills and all that thing and kind of get a system in order, but then what?
I would actually even make it simpler than that. I would say ask yourself the question, what are the two or three things that I could do or start to do that reduce my financial stress? You know, maybe you make a plan to pay down your credit card debt. That'd be good. Maybe, and this is a really good one, maybe you draw up a budget that realistically reflects your current financial situation.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about cleaning up our personal finances for the spring. Joining us is Gail Blanke. You might remember her. She's the author of the book Throw Out 50 Things. She talked about how to kind of start small and clean up your act. And she's also got some advice about financial spring cleaning. Okay, here's a tricky question, and I'm sure that you've heard this. You know, often couples are, if people are in partnership with someone, often, you know, they say opposites attract. Maybe one person is a saver, one person is a spender, and they have different styles, let's say, when it comes to money. And how would you recommend that somebody reconcile these differences? I mean, how would you navigate that? How would you even open that conversation up?
You know, I think most really good conversations that involve change start not with, okay, let's make some changes around here, but rather, what would good look like for us? You know, you have to create a vision. I always love to quote Walt Disney. He always said when they were building a new theme park in any part of the world, he would say, build the castle first, because, you know, that's where the magic is. And if you've got the castle to look to, you can do all the tough stuff to bring the rest of the theme park to life. You know, you lay the cables in the swamps with the heat and the mosquitoes. So ask each other this question. Hey, if it were good, what would it look like, this financial situation? Just for a minute, how good would that be? And how would we feel? And then you can ask the next question is, okay, so what's standing in the way of that? So it's not anybody's fault. It's, we could figure this out together. What could we do differently, or how could we think about it differently? Then you've got a nice conversation going where there's a solution that you're trying to arrive at together. And, you know, I would introduce humor and, you know, and again, anything to keep yourselves from getting worked up about it.
Keep yourselves from getting worked up. That's good.
Just don't get worked up.
Just don't get worked up. So, Gail, before we let you go, you know, I'm sure that there are people who will be hearing our conversation who will say, yeah, I know that. I've heard this before. I know I should do it. But for whatever reason, something's stopping them. You know, they feel afraid. They feel like, it's too big. It's too much. I just can't handle it. Is there some piece of advice that you could get for someone who just is afraid to get started.
It's okay to be afraid. Most of us are really afraid of the whole conversation because we're afraid that, you know, we're just not going to be good at this, that we haven't been good at it in the past, we'll never be good at it. And it makes us feel bad about ourselves. And the point is, you don't have to be perfect. You just have to get into the game. You just have to begin to tackle it. You know, a friend of mine defines the word fear as false evidence appearing real. And so we get worked up about the worst case scenarios and all the stuff that isn't even happening that absolutely paralyzes us. So let that go. That's something to shred, your old fears, you know, your old fear of just not being good enough.
And don't get worked up.
That's the main thing. Don't do it.
Gail Blanke is author of the book Throw Out 50 Things and the founder and CEO of Life Designs. That's her executive and life coaching firm. And she was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York. Gail Blanke, it's always good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's wonderful to talk to you, Michelle.
Looks like a lot of teenagers will be staying up very late tonight to see the film The Hunger Games. It opens at midnight in many theaters across the country. It's based on a young adult bestseller about teens in a televised fight to the death. Pre-opening sales are in the millions, which may render reviews superfluous, but Bob Mondello has one anyway.
Hungry for a good dystopia? Have I got a feast for you. A society built on the ruins of war-torn North America, where the war's victors live in a shining city on a hill and keep the losers, the 99% maybe, in the direst poverty. The fat cats in the capital also remind the losers how subjugated they are with an annual televised ritual called the Hunger Games.
So it was decreed that each year the 12 districts of Pan Am shall offer up in tribute one young man and woman between the ages of 12 and 18 to be trained in the art of survival and to be prepared to fight to the death.
Competitors are chosen by lottery in each of Pan Am's 12 districts, then forced to battle in an arena where cameras capture their every death throw. It's the ultimate TV game show. First place gets you a life free from starvation. Second place, well, there is no second place. But as everyone keeps saying, may the odds be ever in your favor. Selected from District 12, which looks a lot like Depression-era Appalachia, is a baker's son,
Peter Malark,
and a coal miner's daughter so afraid of her own shadow that she wouldn't last 2 minutes in the arena.
Primrose Everdeen.
Her older sister Katniss can't let that stand.
I volunteer! I volunteer as tribute.
Volunteering to be slaughtered. Great TV moment, right? Captured on lots of screens, so you won't miss that point. In the novel, it's easy to forget about the TV cameras because 16-year-old Katniss is the narrator, and when she plunges into the arena, you plunge in with her. That's a level of engagement most filmmakers would, pardon the expression, kill for. But film director Gary Ross wants a different sort of audience buy-in. He keeps cutting to a blue-haired TV host named Caesar.
Hit the 17, the girl on fire!
To emphasize what you might call a celebrity TV on steroids creepiness. This is, after all, kids killing kids as entertainment, American Idol with knives. And once the games begin, the movie audience is as guilty of being entertained as the folks in the Capitol.
They just want a good show. That's all they want.
There's 24 of us, Gail. Only one comes out.
The film's biggest asset is Jennifer Lawrence, who makes Katniss just as tough and smart as the last coal miner's daughter she played in Winter's Bone, where she was also protecting younger siblings. If you're older than the film's target audience, that won't be the only outside reference that'll occur to you. There's the dressing up to be selected to die scene from the short story The Lottery, the Wizard of Oz meets Dr. Seuss hair and fashions of the capital city, the plot that mirrors the Japanese teen flick Battle Royale, and lots of Fall of Rome references, including the name of the country itself, Panem, which sounds like a shortening of Pan American, but is actually from the Latin for bread and circuses, Panem et Circenses. In fact, when Katniss was being coached for her first TV interview...
So you're here to make me look pretty.
I'm here to help you make an impression.
It even occurred to me that there was a Pygmalion thing going on with her makeover, not because she's humming the Rain in Spain while being dressed to kill, but because The Hunger Games is such a relentless aggregator of pop culture references, you figure the connection must have occurred to someone. The movie doesn't actually have a lot to say about the social issues it brings up, and its literalness did make me question things I hadn't while reading the book. Like, a society with hovercraft and digitally created carnivores is still this dependent on coal? But its pacing is brisk, the stakes as high as stakes get, and the leading lady engaging enough that the box office odds, at least, will be ever in its favor. I'm Bob Mondello.